Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. This is the Second Amendment, and this is the Gun Guy.
Boom, 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 boom. Bang, 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 bang. Boom, 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 boom. Bang, bang, bang.
With Guy Ralford on 93 WIBC.
Well, good afternoon, and welcome to the Gun Guy Show here on 93 WIBC. We're so happy that you're with us. Glad you're listening. Beautiful day, man. Feels like spring out there. That's always nice in Indiana about this time of year. I saw a whole bunch of my fellow motorcycle riders, my Harley brothers out there today, and that was awesome. And I taught a private class today, which I really enjoyed. And I'll tell you, in terms of my training that I'm doing, obviously I teach my Essentials of Indiana Gun Law class that you hear me talk about often here on the Gun Guy Show. But I've kind of, as far as actual firearms training, I've gotten out of the group classes. I mean, I taught those for several decades, actually. And what I've decided I really enjoy doing and I like doing and can really accomplish a lot is just going to very small private classes, 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hours with individuals or couples or maybe a family of three, maybe four. I try to keep it under four. And I taught one of those this morning at Indy Arms, young lady who had done a little shooting, but not in a while, and not a lot of formal instruction. And man, she knocked it out of the park. She did a fabulous job. And a little bit of training on the fundamentals goes a long, long way. And that's always fun. If you're interested in that, let me know. You know, on social media, you can go to the website, tactical-firearms.com. But at any rate, that's how I started my day. And then, hey, I've got a big trial, which I'm not going to talk about substantively at all until well after it's over. But I've got a big trial coming up, so that's kind of been dominating my schedule a little bit. But I'm happy to be here in the studio and doing the Gun Guy Show. A lot has happened just in the last week on Second Amendment issues, and a lot of this is interesting. A lot of this is related to some degree to what I talked about a lot last week. You know, the discussion last week generated probably more messages and like whether it's DMs on social media or you know, contacts otherwise. Or some contacts on Twitter. By the way, you can follow the show and actually watch the show on YouTube. I always say the exact same thing. I'm not much to look at, but if you want to get video, and there's a chat feature on YouTube, and a lot of people ask questions. Obviously, I'm doing live radio, so I can't necessarily just sit and stare at the chat feature, but I try to be responsive to that as well. So you can go to YouTube, just look for WIBC or the Gun Guy Show, and it'll pop right up, and you'll see us right here in the studio. Producer Jack and I sitting here cranking it out for WIBC listeners. But as I talked about a lot last week on the show, I got a tremendous amount of feedback on. Mostly positive, not all positive, but we were talking about really where basic human rights come from, including your right to defend yourself, defend your family, what the founders called unalienable rights endowed by our Creator. And endowed by our Creator pretty much answers that question in terms of where those rights come from. And if our rights are endowed by our Creator and they are not given to us by the Constitution, people talk about, well, the Second Amendment gives me the right. No, no, no. The Second Amendment protects from infringement by the government your right to keep and bear arms. It didn't create the right. You had that right already. You were born with that right. Because as our founder said, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And how much of a right do you have to life if you don't have the means of defending your life? None. How much of a right to liberty do you have if you can't stand up to a tyrannical government? None. And happiness, hey, if I can't defend my family, my home, my belongings, my business, I mean, how much of a right to happiness do I have? And so it's an inherent right, and that's where the Second Amendment comes from, is your inherent natural right. The founders, if you read the Federalist Papers, and I really commend this. I'm telling you, you go through, I took during COVID, you know, when we were on complete lockdown. I mean, hey, I work in a one-person office, so I pretty much went to work every day. But it was tough to get much business done because, like, the courts were shut down and people weren't calling, so there was a lot of dead time. And I took a bunch of internet courses. And one I took was the Federalist Papers. And listen, I had studied the Federalist Papers in college. I'd read them on my own, but I went back. And this is all through Hillsdale. Hillsdale College is right over in Illinois, but they have a great internet educational program. And I took a course on the Federalist Papers. And as part of this, you know, of course, you're getting your credit card out, and they send you a bunch of the written materials if you want them in book form. Obviously, there are online resources as well. But the Federalist Papers make it abundantly clear that our system of government is based on the concept that's laid right out in the Declaration of Independence. And listen, the Declaration of Independence has no real force of law like the Constitution does. The Declaration of Independence was really a sales pitch to a large degree to the country on why we were declaring independence from England, from Great Britain, and it was telling King George specifically why it was we were cutting those ties. But it was laying out the reasons why the founders felt it so necessary, in fact, imperative, to cut ties with England and to create our own country. The Constitution is what creates that country, lays out our system of government, and obviously it has the force of law. It is the supreme law of the land. The Declaration of Independence isn't a document. I can't go into court and say, look, it says right here in the Declaration of Independence that this, that, and the other thing, and win a case on that. Now I can say that it sheds light on what the Constitution means because it's the same people. It's the same people. Thomas Jefferson is the primary author of the Declaration of Independence, not the only one. Ben Franklin and others weighed in. Madison is the primary author of the Bill of Rights, although not the only one. There were several others as well. But when you look at the Declaration of Independence and you look at the Federalist Papers, it certainly sheds light on the intent that these same people, these same founders had when they created our system of government. And they then took the next step 2 years after the Constitution was ratified, when they went back and ratified, I mean, it's the states who ratified, but they went back and created the Bill of Rights and submitted those to the states for ratification. And so it all ties together in terms of interpretation, in terms of understanding the meaning and understanding the intent. But when you look at the Federalist Papers and you look at the Declaration of Independence, there's a whole lot of discussion of nature's God and laws of nature. And then when the founders talk about certain unalienable rights endowed by our Creator, that to me, that's obviously important, and that's the part of the Declaration of Independence that you always hear about. But to me, the next few sentences after that are equally as important, because it says to preserve those rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. So it talks right about that. I mean, these are the same people that wrote our Constitution, and they're saying the function of government is to preserve these unalienable rights. Not to infringe them. What are we constantly fighting against right now? What am I? What do I? Have I made a career out of? What do I talk about on the radio? It's fighting against the infringement of our in this particular case with me, mainly Second Amendment rights, I mean, I've had cases in court where I've talked about First Amendment, I've talked about Fourth Amendment, but primarily, obviously, I'm a 2A guy. That's why I got it tattooed here on the forearm. But we're fighting all this time. We put so much time and energy into fighting the government from infringing our rights when the founders said the very function of government is to preserve those unalienable rights that are bestowed on us by God, by our Creator. And how horribly ironic, and I feel bad. I feel bad for the founders. And listen, I won't get into religious beliefs. If you believe that, you know, people who are no longer with us in this life are looking down from heaven or otherwise can observe what's going on, I think I do. I mean, I think that's part of it. But I feel bad if the founders are looking down on what's going on now, that we have to have this dedicated effort to constantly, vigilantly fight the very government that's supposed to be preserving our rights, that's constantly seeking to attack them and minimize them and eradicate them. I mean, you had Hillary Clinton running for president saying, oh no, the Second Amendment doesn't confer any or protect. She said confer, but she should have said protect. But then she went on to make more of a mistake, which is she just said it doesn't confer any individual rights. No, it's only if you're in the National Guard, because it talks about a well-regulated militia. So here you got somebody running for government, trying to eradicate an inherent right, an essential right that the government, that the founders set out to protect against government infringement. But that's where we are. And forgive the soapbox here a little bit, but when I get in here next segment and talk about what's been going on this week, we had Vice President Kamala Harris going to Parkland, Florida, and not just to Parkland, but to actually Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, where we had a mass shooting here 6 years ago. 6 years ago, last February. And 17 students lost their lives. Several other people were wounded. And she went to Parkland. And why was she there? Was she there to listen to what parents had to say about how to keep kids safe in schools? Was she there to pay respects? Well, you would think so from the photo op. But no, she was there to pitch gun control. She was there to pitch gun control. She was there to pitch the minimization of constitutional rights. And when we come back, I want to play for you. One father of a 14-year-old victim of the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School had something to say about Kamala's photo op in the very school where his 14-year-old daughter lost her life. And this is... this is a big deal. This is important, and I'm looking forward to playing that for you. Right now, we're taking a break. This is Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Second to none on the Second Amendment. This is The Gun Guy with Guy Relford on 93 WIBC.
And welcome back. I'm Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC. So this past week, our beloved Vice President Kamala Harris, the brain trust of the Biden administration, I tried to say that with a straight face and without laughing, and it just didn't quite work out. But she went to Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, the scene of a horrific mass shooting, several students killed. And she went down there to announce a couple of things. One is that she is now the head of the new White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. So thank God that we now have Kamala Harris in charge of gun violence prevention in the White House, which obviously means in this country. And, you know, I first saw this and I was like, oh, great. You know, there's a new office created in the White House. that's designed specifically to infringe on our Second Amendment rights. But then I said, hold on, look who's leading the Office of Gun Violence Prevention in the White House. It's Kamala Harris. And if she does exactly the same job that she's done on the border, as she's now been tasked with infringing our gun rights, then we don't have much to worry about for the foreseeable future. I mean, she's the border czar, right? And look what a complete disaster that is. So if Biden has put her in charge of gun control, I don't think there's much to worry about. Now, you would like to think that, listen, I mean, take gun out of it. You know, White House Office of Violence Prevention. Hey, do we have too much violence in this country? Of course we do. Do we have too much violence right here in Indiana, where I'm broadcasting from? Of course we do. Violence prevention in and of itself is not a bad thing. But when Kamala Harris says gun violence prevention, when Joe Biden says gun violence prevention, when the Democrats in Congress say it, what are they talking about? They're not really talking about reducing gun violence. They're talking about infringing your Second Amendment rights and my Second Amendment rights. That's what they're talking about. They like to put it in words that sound like violence prevention, but that's not what they're talking about at all. And this is important for everyone to understand. And next segment, I'm going to play this video. You'll hear the audio from Ryan Petty again. Is the father of a victim, a 14-year-old little girl who lost her life in a school shooting, and she had strong words for this. But what Kamala was also there to promote and get her photo ops there in at the scene of a horrible mass shooting. And this is a different shooting scene really than exists anywhere else in the country in terms of a mass shooting and particularly a school shooting, because they had the criminal trial for the lowlife. And I do not mention mass shooters' names on the Gun Guy Show. I don't, I won't, never will. But the idiot and psychopath who committed that horrific shooting, he went through a criminal trial. The real issue was he fully responsible? There was no question he did what he did. The question was he fully accountable? Was he fully responsible for his actions? And the question was whether he should get the death penalty or not, because everyone knew he did what he did, and he admitted he did what he did. But his lawyers went down there and argued that, you know, his mother was an alcohol abuser, and he may have had fetal alcohol syndrome, and he had all these disadvantages as a youth. And so the question was whether or not he should get the death penalty. And ultimately, the jury could not decide. The jury hung, meaning they could not reach a unanimous verdict on whether he should get the death penalty, so he ended up getting life in prison. But because the trial judge down there wanted to preserve the ability of the jurors to go actually see the crime scene at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, they essentially sealed the crime scene and left it exactly as it existed immediately after that shooting. I mean, we're talking about, you know, snacks on desks and blood-stained walls. I mean, really a horrific scene. I mean, they left it like it was immediately after the shooting. Blood on the floor, blood on the walls, personal belongings scattered around, shoes left in the hallways as kids were sprinting out of the school, or trying to, ran right out of their shoes, left them in the hallways. And that's what Marjory Stoneman Douglas still looks like today, that high school. And a lot of the parents call it hallowed ground, and I understand why they're saying that. I mean, this is where their loved ones lost their lives. A lot of them are calling for it to be demolished. But that's where Kamala Harris decided to have her photo op, and as part of that, not only did she announce this, and this has actually been around, I think, since November or so, so it's not brand new, this office, White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, but did also announce something that is brand new, just announced last week, which is the National Emergency Protective Order Resource Center, ERPO. And what is an ERPO? It's a red flag order. What's a red flag order? A red flag order is something that seizes guns from someone who's not been convicted of any crime, who's not been adjudicated to be mentally ill, but seizes their guns based on the allegation that they're quote-unquote dangerous. And the ERPOs are essentially red flag laws. And we have, right here in Indiana, we have the second oldest red flag law in the country. We've had ours since 2005. And the national ERPO, or call them red flag laws, the National Red Flag Resource Center, actually is funded by $750 million that Congress authorized through the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. Remember this? This is, a year and a half or so ago. Voted for by our own Todd Young, Republican. But the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, which is looking at gun control, did a few things, but one of the things it did is it provided $750 million for exactly this kind of a resource center. And what is its goal? Google it. You can go to the federal website. It could actually be administered by the Bloomberg School and the college is escaping me. I'll remember it here in a second. But is a college long known for espousing gun control that's funded by Michael Bloomberg, biggest gun control advocate on the planet, is actually administering this thing. But what it is, it's providing resources to help you. If you want to pick up the phone and eradicate someone's Second Amendment rights through one of these red flag orders, this resource center is providing you with all the resources you need to get that done. That's the goal of it. We'll talk more about that, but we'll also talk about how one particular dad of a victim of the shooting in Parkland at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School how he felt and how he stated on social media how he felt about the Vice President of the United States using the place where his daughter died as a place to make a photo op and come down and make a political statement calling for more gun control. That's what we'll go to when we come back. We'll also take your calls. We'd love to take your calls here on The Gun Guy Show. 317-239-9393. That's 317-239-9393. This is Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC.
The show about gun rights, gun safety, and responsible gun ownership. This is The Gun Guy with Guy Relford on 93 WIBC.
And welcome back. I'm Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC. So as I mentioned earlier in the show, Kamala Harris goes to Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. She's arguing for more gun control, and she's doing so right there in the building where a lot of innocent children lost their lives. Some administrators, too. One heroic teacher charged the shooter and lost his life. I mean, a lot of heroism, a lot of failure. The school resource officer whose job it was, the armed school resource officer whose job it was to keep those kids safe, hid behind his car outside the building, never went in the building for the whole duration of the shooting. There's a lot of failure, too. But the reason for Kamala's visit, as I mentioned, was to call for gun control. And one particular father wasn't real happy about it.
English classroom. I expressed some frustration today on social media about a visit to Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, where my daughter Elena was killed in her English classroom over 6 years ago now. What's frustrating to me is that this building should have been demolished years ago. And it's now being used as a photo op for politicians that want to push an agenda. But politicians that, quite frankly, don't understand what it takes to protect our nation's schools, don't understand the causes of the Parkland tragedy, don't understand what led to the tragedy and are just there, quite frankly, to push their gun control agenda. I'm tired of it. It needs to stop. The building needs to be demolished. And that I know many of the other families view that ground as sacred ground at this point. And the sooner these photo ops stop, the happier we'll be. The vice president and
there you hear it. And it goes on. If you want to look this up, you can just Google it. Parkland dad, his name's Ryan Petty, expresses frustration with Kamala Harris' visit is a common headline. But you look it up. You listen to the whole 9 minutes is really compelling. It doesn't work well to play the whole thing on radio, but it's really very important what this guy has to say. And listen, he's not just a parent. Ryan Petty sat on the Parkland Commission that heard hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of testimony on exactly what led to the shooting and how this was allowed to occur. And he's got a lot of thoughts. In fact, he championed some legislation in Florida to help prevent this kind of thing from happening. And guess what? None of it involved gun control. Because what the Parkland Commission actually concluded was this was caused not by any failures of laws, obviously, but it was caused by the fact that authorities ignored the threats from this kid with a whole history, I mean, long history of violence for no older than he was. Long history of threats. The FBI was advised on two separate occasions that this guy had threatened to be a mass shooter and had posted on social media he wanted to be, I think the quote was, professional school shooter. And the FBI ignored all that. The local authorities had been called to his, I think it was his step-parents or even foster parents home, but had been called dozens of times because of this kid being violent. The school had a policy that if someone was violent in the school, they wouldn't ask for them to be prosecuted. They would specifically prevent the kid from being prosecuted because they felt that had racial overtones to it in terms of a disproportionate amount of minorities were being prosecuted in that circumstance. And so they would shield these kids from any kind of accountability when they were violent, even in the school. And that was the school district there in Parkland who made that decision. Then you had the failings of law enforcement. You had the failings of the school resource officer whose job it was to protect those kids and who cowered outside the building behind a car, listening to people scream, listening to people get shot for several minutes. And the commission report goes on and on and on, and never does it say, wow, if we just had this one additional law in place after this psychopath violated law after law after law, nowhere did that commission, in that commission conclusion, did they say, wow, if we'd had this one more law, we could have prevented this. No, existing laws needed to be enforced, and people needed to do their jobs. And the school needed better systems and better infrastructure and better security to keep bad guys out. This guy walked through an unlocked door. He walked across the whole campus with a rifle case. People saw him with walkie-talkies in their hand and ignored him, walking across campus, a kid with a history of violence, walking across campus toward the building with a rifle case in his hand. And nobody called for a lockdown. Nobody called law enforcement. He walked in unlocked doors and started killing innocent kids. That's what led to the Parkland shooting. And that's why you hear frustration in Ryan Petty's voice when he's watching a photo op from our vice president saying, well, we need to prevent this from happening by passing gun control laws. He lost his beautiful 14-year-old daughter. Many other parents lost kids in that building. Other people lost family members of teachers and staff. And it's insulting to them. You heard it straight from his from his lips. And go out there and Google it. Ryan Petty, Parkland, Kamala Harris. It'll come right up. Watch the whole nine-minute video. He's powerful in saying what he's saying, which is these politicians who just want to eradicate Second Amendment rights and are trying to pass their pre-existing political agenda, standing on the bodies of innocent kids like his daughter, is offensive to him, and he says that in exactly those words. And right now we're a little past three-quarter hour, and people are calling in. I'm going to go to the phone lines to the extent we can. But people ought to listen to this, and people ought to understand, people in the middle of it who understand what it takes to at least limit violence from mass shooters and violence in schools. The people who have studied it and heard the evidence, they're not talking about more laws. They're talking about more secure schools, and they're talking about people doing their jobs and enforcing existing laws. That's what we're talking about. Right now, we're taking a break. This is Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Your rights, your responsibilities, your guns. This is The Gun Guy with Guy Relford on 93 WIBC.
And welcome back. I'm Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC. By the way, it just dawned on me that the college that's administering this Red Flag National Resource Center for the Biden administration is Johns Hopkins. It's a Bloomberg School of Public Policy at Johns Hopkins. I started to see James Madison. I'm like, hold on, no, wait a minute. I was just talking about Madison in a different context. And for some reason, Johns Hopkins would not come to me. But in the meantime, I'll tell you what, John has called in. And I'm getting ready to shift gears on topics a little bit anyway. So it's a good time to go to the phone lines. And John, you had a question.
Afternoon, Guy.
Afternoon, sir.
To begin with, that father is probably going to get audited by the IRS next year.
I'm sure that's true. That's right.
But reference Castle Doctrine and curtilage.
Yeah.
2 a.m., I'm in my attached garage with the door open halfway, and somebody decides to invite themselves into my garage.
Yeah.
How does that apply versus them just walking through my front door?
Well, that's a great question, John. And it's something I talk about in my gun law class that you hear me talk about here on the show often. And the reason John asked that question, and I've got a little less than 2 minutes here, but is that the Castle Doctrine portion of the Indiana self-defense statute says that you can use reasonable force, including deadly force, to prevent or terminate an unlawful entry into or attack on your dwelling. Okay, that's your home. And then it says curtilage or occupied motor vehicle. So the question then becomes, what the hell is curtilage? And curtilage basically is the area outside the walls of your home where normal domestic activities occur, where you have an expectation of privacy, and it helps if you have some kind of an enclosure like a security fence around your home and the area claimed to be curtilage. So what does that really mean? John, first of all, we don't have a single self-defense case in Indiana that interprets the word curtilage. We've got some factors that have been identified and that say things like, well, the distance between your home, that matters. Again, whether you've taken measures to protect the privacy of that area, And basically what I just went through, your attached garage, is that your curtilage? I'll tell you where I come down on it. It is so undefined that I would not rely on curtilage to ever use force or deadly force in particular. What I would do is make sure I can defend myself based on the fact that I'm preventing serious bodily injury or the commission of a forcible felony. Outside the actual walls of your home, we just don't know enough about what the hell curtilage means in the courts. That's what I say in my gun law class. In the meantime, we're at the top of the hour. It's time to take a break. This is Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. This is the Second Amendment, and this is The Gun Guy.
Boom, 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 boom. Bang, 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 bang. Boom, 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 boom. Bang, bang, bang.
With Guy Ralford on 93 WIBC.
And welcome back for hour number two of the Gun Guy Show here on 93 WIBC. And I want to talk now about what's going on in the Supreme Court. And listen, we're still waiting on this Rahimi decision, which makes me nervous. And if you haven't heard me talk about that before, or if you don't recall what I'm talking about, what it is Rahimi's a guy who's challenging the law, the federal law that says if you have a domestic violence order of protection issued against you, you can't possess a firearm. And listen, there are some powerful arguments in support of his position because, first of all, the process where you can get a domestic violence order of protection issued against you, it doesn't require you to commit any crime. And now, if you've committed crimes, that can certainly result in a domestic violence order of protection being issued against you. If the crimes involve stalking or abusing physically included a domestic partner, an intimate partner, as the statute talks about, that could certainly result in that domestic violence order of protection being issued. But it doesn't require you to be arrested or convicted of any crime. And it's considered a civil proceeding. And that's important because it means you don't have a right to counsel. If you can't afford a lawyer, then you don't get one appointed for him. And the burden of proof is just what we call preponderance of the evidence. That's like the greater weight of credible evidence, which is like 51%, 50.0001%. We'll get you convicted. So it's not beyond a reasonable doubt, like in a criminal case. So you go through a civil proceeding with no right to counsel, which means you're deprived due process. And that can result in the eradication of your Second Amendment rights. And that is a real issue for a lot of people. And Rahimi was found guilty of violating that law because he had a domestic violence order of protection issued against him in Texas. And he appealed that, saying, no, the law is unconstitutional. And the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, ultimately, and there in Texas, is Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, is who that Court of Appeals has jurisdiction over, are the states that it has jurisdiction over. It said, no, it's unconstitutional. And it's now before the Supreme Court. And I've been saying all along that I'm nervous about this decision because Rahimi's not a good guy. There's a reason he had a domestic violence order of protection. And the evidence seems to be pretty consistent. And even his own lawyer had to admit in the argument before the Supreme Court here three months ago that he's got a history of violence, even though he hadn't been convicted of a crime that led to the domestic violence order of protection being issued against him. There's still evidence that he's a very violent guy. He had abused multiple women. He was abusing one woman and someone, a bystander, tried to intervene. He actually fired shots at the bystander. Now, why that didn't get him convicted of a crime, I do not know. Sounds like it should have. But he's not a good guy. And even some of the more conservative justices during that oral argument were asking questions like, well, this is to his lawyer. Don't you have to admit that he's a violent guy? And I think what the Supreme Court may very likely do in that case, because what they're doing now is they're applying this new test that came out of the Bruin decision, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, just, what, a year and a half old or so, that said now the test to determine whether a gun control law is constitutional under the Second Amendment is you look at the text, history, and tradition of the Second Amendment. So what's it say? Well, the Heller decision from 2008 tells us a lot about what it says, what it means. But then you look at the history and tradition of how how laws have been enforced and upheld in looking at what kind of laws generally are considered to pass constitutional muster over history. And the time you're looking at is the founding, 1791, when the Second Amendment was ratified, and also, like, it's 1868 when the 14th Amendment was ratified, which made the Second Amendment apply to the states. And so, if you can't find historical analogs, historical examples of the same kinds of laws in that time frame, then the Bruin decision says that law is unconstitutional. And listen, domestic violence orders of protection haven't been around very long, and it's pretty easy to say, well, no, that, of course, the, you know, laws that deprive Second Amendment rights from people under a protective order didn't exist in 1868. They sure as hell didn't exist in 1791. Therefore, this is unconstitutional. But I think what the Supreme Court may likely do, and I think this is going to be influenced by the fact that Rahimi's not a good guy, is they're going to look at whether there's a historical analog. They're going to look at it a little more broadly and say, is there a historical analog of laws being upheld that take guns out and keep guns out of the hands of people who are violent? And it'll focus on violence as the issue. Now, I hope, and this may be naive, but I hope they more focus on the due process issues. Not so much on the fact that Rahimi is, in fact, a violent guy, and the evidence pointed pretty clearly in that direction. But to look at the due process issues and say, look, this is a process that's only civil. You don't get a lawyer if you can't afford one. And I, my recollection is Rahimi did not have one. And it's only preponderance of the evidence. How can that deprive you of your constitutional right when you have no right to counsel? You have no real right to due process. I think that's where they ought to focus. But I think they may very likely look at the violent nature of this particular individual and be influenced by that. You hope not. I mean, there's a reason that Lady Justice has a blindfold on in all the statues that you see, because she's not supposed to be influenced by the facts of a particular case. She's supposed to be blind to that and apply the law purely and without prejudice. And that's what the blindfold stands for. And I hope the Supreme Court does that. But anyone who doesn't think the facts of a particular case influence the outcome of that case isn't paying much attention to the judicial system. So we'll see where that goes. But that leads us to a couple of cases that are being reviewed right now by the Supreme Court, where the nine justices get to decide what cases they take and what cases they don't. And they have conferences and they discuss these cases where a party has asked the Supreme Court to take the case in what's called a petition for certiorari. You could call it petition for review, saying, Supreme Court, please take a look at this case. But the Supreme Court, for most cases, the vast, 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 vast majority, the Supreme Court doesn't have to take it if it doesn't want to. And they've passed up a lot of Second Amendment cases over a lot of years, since really 2008. That's why a lot of us were a little pleasantly surprised when they took the Bruin case here just a year and a half, 2 years ago. Well, they took it 2.5, 3 years ago. But they hadn't considered a case since 2008 under the Second Amendment. They'd taken something like 15 to 20 Fourth Amendment cases. They'd taken like 25 First Amendment cases. And in all that time, they wouldn't take any Second Amendment cases. Well, then they took Bruin. But a lot of us are hoping that they take a case right now under review, and it's called Vincent versus Garland. And it's time to take a break, but let me go into the break and leave you with this. Melinda Vincent is now a licensed clinical social worker. She owns her own business. She's a mother. She's a public health activist. But she's also a felon. Back in 2008, she got convicted of a felony for writing a bad check for under $500 at a grocery store. That's a pretty big grocery store bill, especially back in 2008. $500 doesn't get you near as much under the Biden administration. But that's a great big old bill. But she wrote a bad check to a grocery store. And on that basis, she got convicted of check fraud, which was a felony. This is out in Utah. Since that time, she's totally changed her life around. She went to college. She founded a counseling center. She's running what's called the Utah Harm Reduction Coalition. I mean, she's clearly a solid citizen. And her only criminal conviction is for writing a bad check. But the federal law says if you have any felony conviction, you can't possess a firearm. Well, Melinda Vinson is challenging that. And we'll talk about how that factors in to the broader discussion because, oh, by the way, another case is very similar, a case called Range versus U.S. And in Range versus U.S., a guy lied on his application for food stamps when he was 19 years old about his income. He understated how much money he made from cutting grass. He understated that to get something like $2,000 in food stamps. And got convicted of a state offense in Pennsylvania for what is essentially welfare fraud. Now, however you feel about welfare fraud, however you feel about people writing bad checks, the question becomes, is that an offense that ought to deprive you of your Second Amendment rights? And is there a history and tradition in this country of taking rights away from nonviolent convicted criminals, including felons? That becomes a more interesting discussion. That's what we'll get into. And take your calls throughout the rest of the show. 317-239-9393. That's 317-239-9393. This is Guy Relford on the Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Now you've got a gun guy. Guy Relford on 93 WIPC.
And welcome back. I'm Guy Relford on the Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC. So we're talking about a couple of cases before the Supreme Court that deal with the issue of whether or not a nonviolent felon ought to lose their gun rights. And listen, the circuit courts, which are the appellate courts that are just below the Supreme Court, they're all over the map on this. Even in the two cases I was talking about, there's the Range case and the Vinson case. In one of them, the Court of Appeals said, oh no, nonviolent felons can't be prohibited from possessing firearms. There's no historical precedent for that. That's unconstitutional. And in the other one, they said, oh yeah, that's fine. You can do that if you want to. So what's the Supreme Court likely to do? There's some interesting background on this. When you look at what the Supreme Court's already said in the Heller case, which I just mentioned, 2008, I mean, that was such an important case. I mean, listen, we almost lost the Second Amendment completely in the Heller case. By one vote, the Supreme Court said the Second Amendment even protects an individual right to bear arms. Because four out of nine, said, oh, no. It starts off, a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. So unless you're in a state militia, which is now the National Guard, the Second Amendment does nothing for you, doesn't protect anything for you at all. There is no individual right to bear arms. Four justices out of nine said that in 2008. By the skin of our teeth, the majority, five justices, said, no. It does protect an individual right to bear arms because the militia in 1791, when the Second Amendment was ratified, was the whole of the people. It was the common man. Today we'd say the common people. It was the whole of the people who can be called upon to defend the country, to defend the security of a free state in the wording of the Second Amendment. But that was a one vote majority. So we almost lost the Second Amendment in terms of individuals. Completely in 2008. But in order to get a majority in that decision, and this is some scuttlebutt, but it's something I've heard for a long time, is You know, the swing vote for a lot of decisions when he was still on the bench was Justice Anthony Kennedy, because he was a guy that would kind of lean liberal on some issues. He'd lean conservative on others, and he was often a swing vote. And the word is that in order to get his vote in the Heller case, to protect the fact that there is even a right to bear arms at all possessed by individuals in this country, that he insisted there be language in the opinion that says this in the Heller decision from 2008, nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons. So there you've got that language right out of Heller that, again, was primarily very, very positive. In fact, it was life-saving in terms of what the Second Amendment does or does not do for us in this country. But in order to get that majority, the word is, that's the deal that was struck to get Kennedy's vote, because it could have gone the other way. But where are we now? Anthony Kennedy's no longer on the bench. You have Amy Coney Barrett now on the bench. And the reason I mentioned Justice Barrett is that when she was still on the Seventh Circuit, the Court of Appeals, before she got appointed and confirmed to the Supreme Court, she wrote an opinion. It said there's no historical precedent for taking the Second Amendment rights away from nonviolent felons. That's unconstitutional. Now, that was in a dissenting opinion, so she got outvoted 2-1 by two other judges. But she's now on the Supreme Court. You have Brett Kavanaugh. You have Neil Gorsuch. You don't have Anthony Kennedy. And you have, by and large, a 6-3 majority, 5.5, depending on what Chief Justice Roberts does. But it's still pretty damn solid. So where the court would go with this issue now, I think, could potentially be decidedly different. And to say, they could easily say, when we said felons in Heller, we were talking about violent felons. We weren't talking about someone who writes a bad check to a grocery store when they're 19 years old. We're not talking about someone who lies about their income to get food stamps. Those aren't the kind of crimes that we need to eradicate constitutional freedoms from those people over in order to protect society. Is society any safer if we take the gun rights away from someone who wrote a bad check 15 years ago or who lied about their food stamp application 30 years ago? Well, hell no. Of course not. And there's no logical argument that we are. But that's where this leads us, and it's really interesting to me because we have the constituency of the court that we have now, and we're waiting right now to hear whether the court will even take these two cases. They're being discussed in conference. And get this, there doesn't even need to be a majority of justices that want to hear a case in order for that case to be heard by the Supreme Court. There's something called the rule of four. And this is not written down in a statute anywhere. It's not in the Constitution anywhere. It's just sort of a habit and custom that's arisen within the Supreme Court itself. But if four justices out of nine want to hear a case, then the court hears the case. And listen, you know there's a lot of horse trading and brokering and discussion going on to say, all right, if we take this case, how would you vote on it? What do you, which way would you lean on it? I mean, they don't want to take a case. Those people that are advocating to take a case don't necessarily want to take the case if they don't think they have the votes for that to go the way they want it to go. They'd rather leave it alone. And I think that's where we were for years after the Heller decision and the McDonald decision just came down 2 years later in 2010. And what McDonald did is it said, yeah, Heller's decision, which dealt with a federal law in Washington, D.C., also applies to the states. And the states have to honor and protect and may not infringe our Second Amendment rights as well as the federal government. But that was 2010, and a lot of us said for a lot of years the reason the court didn't take Second Amendment cases in the meantime, I mentioned they passed up dozens and dozens and dozens. Well, they took all these First Amendment cases and Fourth Amendment cases, Eighth Amendment cases. They didn't take any Second Amendment ones. And a lot of people are saying, well, they're not so pro-2A after all. Well, a lot of us really believed the people who wanted to review those cases, people like Justice Thomas, who's incredibly strong on 2A, were concerned about whether they had the votes to make it go the right way. And if they didn't, they didn't want to take it. I think now they clearly have the votes. And both Range and Vincent, I'm fascinated because, you know, I mentioned the Rahimi case, and he's a bad guy. And a lot of times, you know, bad facts make bad law is an old saying among lawyers. And Rahimi being a violent dude, nobody looks at this guy's history and they want to give him his gun rights back. And he's the guy who just had the case argued before the Supreme Court. The court did take the case, and we'll see what they do with it. We're waiting on a decision. It'll probably come out early summer or a little later this spring. But he was a violent guy, and nobody looks at him and says, boy, I'm really just in the pit of my stomach want to give you your gun rights back based on who he is. That's not what's supposed to influence the balance of the scale. That's not how it's supposed to work. But I'm concerned about it. Well, the two litigants, the two plaintiffs in these two cases of Range and Vincent are perfect examples of why it makes no sense to strip Second Amendment rights away from nonviolent felons who have felonies from a long time ago, who have completely turned their lives around, and where there's absolutely no concern about these people actually being a danger to society if they can legally carry a gun again. Keep in mind, these are people who want to restore their legal rights. If they're really dangerous, and I've made this argument in court before, you know, I'm in trying to restore people's rights who have different things on their background. Said, I'll say, Your Honor, they hired a lawyer. They came in here before you because they want to carry a gun legally. If this was someone you really had to worry about, do you think they'd care about legally restoring their rights? They just carry a gun and they just commit crimes because they don't care about the rule of law if that's who they were. They're not that person because they care about legally carrying a gun and they won't carry a gun unless you restore their rights. That's the kind of person you never had to worry about to begin with. And that's the argument. Right now, we're a little past bottom of the hour. It's time to take a break. We'll go to the phone lines when we come back and join the discussion, 317-239-9393. That's 317-239-9393. This is Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
He's a Second Amendment attorney. He's an NRA certified firearms instructor. He's the gun guy. Guy Relford on 93 WIPC.
And welcome back. I'm Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC. And I'll tell you what, Jeff's been on hold for a long time. Let's go to the phone lines. And Jeff, welcome to The Gun Guy Show.
Hey, Guy, I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure, man.
First of all, you're my Matt Dillon of the 2024. And don't take that the wrong way, but you abide by the law first. Thank you for everything you do for the state of Indiana as well as nationally for the Second Amendment.
Well, I appreciate that a lot, Jeff.
No, you're fine, man, and I really appreciate you. I was wondering if you had heard. Now, I don't get to listen to the program a lot. I have an activating company, and I'm not able to do it a lot on Saturdays. But the Byrna, the non-lethal weapon out of Fort Wayne.
Yeah.
What do you know much about it, and would you rather, like, picture me, my kids know everything, to loading and unloading and shooting three rounds out of a 50 caliber, gunpowdered rifle down to a Makarov. But we get older, I have grandkids now, and maybe my offspring have married a little ones that, you know, Maybe they didn't come around and are a little nervous about firepower, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, sure. So you want to know what I think about the Byrna self-defense weapon, I guess you'd have to call it. I've never handled one, Jeff. I've never fired one. But it's they call it a non-lethal weapon. And what it is, it looks like a kind of a plastic pistol, but it shoots a projectile by means of compressed CO2. So it's essentially like a pellet gun or a CO2 gun, an air rifle. But it you have the option of shooting an inert projectile, what it calls, I think they call it a kinetic round, where basically you're thumping somebody with this thing. And it's a good sized projectile. But it's coming out by the force of compressed air. And then they also make, a round that's got like an OC component to it that will, you know, douse somebody with OC residue, or, you know, and that's not gas, it's more of a powder. But, and that's like, you know, like it's going to have the same effect as something like mace, or, you know, the OC spray that a lot of us also like to carry. And what they say on their website, and I haven't looked at it in a while, but when I went there, just cause I was curious, they say, no background checks required, legal to carry in all 50 states. And you know, you're just not regulated, as a firearm. And listen, I've not done any research on it to say that they're wrong, but one thing that's always been interesting to me about like air rifles, I've got a Beeman, what I call an adult air rifle, that shoots a pellet at over 1,000 feet per second, and it's pretty brutal on small varmints that you may not want around the backyard, and a lot of fun just to go out and target shooting with. But 1,000 feet per second is faster than, you know, my .45 shoots, and not too much behind where my 9mm shoots. Now, shooting a small little, you know, 0.117 or 177 projectile, and it loses velocity very, very quickly, but it's still moving pretty good. And the definition of a firearm in Indiana and a federal law is it's really the same definition. It's worded slightly differently, but it's a weapon that expels a projectile by means of an explosion. And if you look up the term explosion, it means the sudden release of gases. Well, does the release of CO2 such to expel a projectile out of the Byrna gun or an air rifle, is that an explosion? And most of us would say probably not. I've never seen a case on this, but an explosion probably means more something that actually involves some combustion, right? Where you got gunpowder burning or something along those lines. That's an explosion. But the term explosion, from a purely technical standpoint, is just a sudden release of gases. And I had somebody read that one time because we were discussing this very issue, and they said, "Hell, that means flatulence is an explosion, right? It's a sudden release of gases." And this has been years since I've looked at it, but that was the laugh we had at the time. So, do I dispute what Byrna says, that it's not regulated as a firearm? Absolutely not. And I'm sure they have lawyers that have looked into this, and I'm sure they have to be confident in that. But I think it's a little bit more of a close question than what they may be giving credit to here. But are they effective? That's what I don't know. But listen, I got a bad guy that just kicked my door down in my house, and he's coming in. As far as I know, he's armed. Do I want to shoot him with that thing or the Remington 870? Now I have next to my bed. I've got a pretty clear preference on that. Listen, I don't want to kill anybody. You've heard me say before, I'll go a long way to avoid it. But if there's an imminent threat and I need to end that threat to defend my life, or more importantly, my family's life and the life of my beautiful wife, then I'm going to make sure I want to get that done. And I don't think Shooting them with an air gun is something I'd be interested in doing, but I leave that open to people because people have considerations like you mentioned, Jeff, as far as, you know, who has access to their homes and, you know, what kind of weapons they want to have around their home, and I completely respect all of that for all the reasons you mentioned. But right now we're taking a break. We'll come back for the last segment, and Joe has a question. Joe, I can't wait to bring you on, man, so don't go anywhere through this break, because Joe has a question about something I've been talking about a lot. And I talked about a lot just last week, and I did so with some pleasure. And it involves a certain former candidate for mayor here in Marion County. And I can't wait to talk to Joe when we come back. Right now, we're taking a break. Join the discussion. I'll have time for another couple calls. 317-239-9393. That's 317-239-9393. This is Guy Relford on The Gun Guy Show on 93 WIBC.
Second to none on the Second Amendment. This is The Gun Guy with Guy Relford on 93 WIPC.
And welcome back to the last segment here on The Gun Guy Show. Producer Jack just had a caller who wanted to have a humorous discussion about flatulence. But we decided that's probably not the way we want to end the show. Hey, it was my fault for bringing it up. But in the meantime, Joe has called in, and I think I'm going to be interested in this question. Joe, welcome to the Gun Guy Show.
Hey, thanks for taking the call.
Of course.
I listen to WIBC at work, and I get bombarded with these Jefferson Shreve commercials.
Yeah.
And where he's lying about his A rating. I didn't know if he could reach out to somebody at the NRA. Maybe they could run a commercial like telling the truth, maybe. You know? because he's going to use, you know, I don't see this guy use his money to lie his way in. I mean, it wouldn't be the first one, but.
No, and Joe, it's a great question, but let me tell you exactly what's going on there, and it's a little sleight of hand. And listen, when a candidate for office, an elected politician in office, when they treat us like we're too stupid to understand really what's going on, that's a big red flag for me. I mean, that's about as bad a thing. And in addition to not respecting my constitutional rights, but treating me like I'm an idiot, those are a couple of things because it's a form of dishonesty. And here's what's going on. And you mentioned him lying about his A rating. Well, and I hear those same commercials. And by the way, to WIBC's credit, no one's ever come to me because I've been a harsh critic of Jefferson Shreve for a while, both during the mayor's race and during now what he's running for now. And for people who don't know or haven't heard me discuss this, what Joe's talking about is the guy, Jefferson Shreve, Indiana businessman. And listen, a self-made guy. And I was actually excited about when he announced he's going to be a candidate for mayor because Joe Hogsett couldn't be a worse mayor. But when Shreve announced he was going to run, because this is a guy who had a home storage business or a self storage business, who built that up from nothing himself, and then sold it for something like $500 million, a billion with a B, and so he earned that money. He built that business up, and so I respect the hell out of that. And so when he announced he was going to run for Joe or against Joe Hogsett for mayor in Indy, I'm like, oh hell yeah, I was all in. I was ready to support him. Well, he went through the Republican primary and won the primary against, including our own Abdul Hakeem Shabazz right here from WIBC, without announcing what his plans were for Second Amendment rights in Marion County. After he wins, this goes to his honesty as well, after he wins the Republican primary for mayor, he comes out where he essentially mirrors the exact same gun control proposals that Joe Hogsett did. Saying, oh, we want to have a so-called assault weapon ban here in Marion County. We want to raise the age to buy any firearm to 21. And we want to roll back constitutional carry in Marion County. And that's those same policies Joe Hogsett was advocating for. And Jefferson Shreve says, oh, yeah, me too. Now, was he just sucking up to the liberal voters in Marion County? Well, yeah. Well, during the mayor's campaign, see, this guy put himself in the worst possible position, and his advisors have to be the dumbest human beings that have ever been involved in politics in the history of politics, because they put him in this trick bag. He was advocating gun control, so people like me were all over his butt. But at the same time, he had run earlier before the mayor's race for state senate. He ran for Jack Sandlin's seat in a primary here in Indianapolis. And as part of that, he filled out a questionnaire for the NRA that said he had an A rating. I mean, he felt based on his questionnaire, he received an A rating. So during the mayor's race, he advocates for gun control, but Hogsett and Hogsett's campaign attacked him for having an A rating from NRA. So that's what he says. He goes, I was attacked for having an A rating by the liberals in Marion County. That's true. But guess what the new rating was? It just came out from NRA, an F as in Foxtrot. And we'll leave you with that. We're at the end of the Gun Guy Show. Come back next week. This is Guy Relford on 93 WIBC.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.